Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Today, on this episode, recording episode 105, and I'm joined by Peter Swim. I have the distinct pleasure and honor to have him with me on the podcast this afternoon. We'll let Peter introduce himself in a second. Peter, welcome to the channel. Welcome to the conversation. I hope you're prepared for the weekend, and I hope you had a good week.
I'm always prepared for the weekend. Thanks for having me, Robin.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for being with me. And I know we do these recordings online. So for the audience, you know, there are some challenges when you do these podcasts online. So if we drop or the signal doesn't help us a little bit, we will get back to you. We'll come back and bring this podcast to fruition at the end of the day. Today, I'm excited about talking to Peter because we have a couple of topics that I would like to cover, which are near and dear to my heart on the AI and the tech side of things. Peter is known for leading voice in conversational AI and human-centered technology. He has spent his career at the intersection of machine intelligence, storytelling, and human behavior, helping some of the world's largest organizations rethink how digital systems communicate with people. I can't wait to dive into this, Peter. I really appreciate the topic.
Oh,
Everybody on this channel, we asked the opening question there, Peter. Everybody's got a story. What's your story?
You know, I've been a technology my entire adult life, basically. My first job in high school was in the 90s. I was helping people at the library learn how to use the internet. And so people of all stripes and backgrounds and, you know, people in their 80s and 90s have been around like before automobiles at the time. And I think that has kind of set the tone for the patchworkness of my work, that I'm basically, my entire career is the intersection of when people have to use a machine to do something. But the reason they're doing it on the machine is not because they want to do it on the machine, but because they've tried everything else, right? And that kind of approach to using technology, where it's either the thing of last resort or first resort, lends itself to a lot of interesting conversations about like meaning and understanding and how things work together. And that's what drove me to form my consultancy, Toyoville, where we help large and small businesses use things like AI and chatbots and things in a smart way that doesn't like rob them of humanity, but also like takes care of a lot of the dirty work and things that are like painful to do.
This is great. Absolutely. Now, when you look at where technology is right now, and we definitely came leaps and bounds from the 90s and the 80s and the 2000, even last year, I mean, the stuff that is coming up so fast at us right now, you can dedicate your entire life trying to study and see where we are. And I know people at CES probably this weekend, they're listening to this conversation. You may be right. There are a few things at CES probably making some eyebrows raise here. So what do you think?
I'm always like fretful when I'm on a podcast and I make a prediction or I say something about the way of the world because something can come out tomorrow that makes everything but in this podcast irrelevant. But also like there's a lot of like Occam's razor to this thing where things are different, but are they better, right? And I think like localization is like another one of those things where for some people, localization is the key, the heart of the thing, the tool they're working on. For other people, it's a job to be done and a thing to check off in the checklist. And so like there's a lot of really interesting technologies around coming out. Like I especially really love like I can hold my phone up to my mouth and talk into it in my language and it comes out in someone else's language and I can help someone at, you know, find the bus that they're looking for and all that. I think that is amazing use of technology. And then on the other end of it, there's like stuff that is just like making things harder. And every year I feel more and more like my grandparents when I'm using things. I'm like, how does this thing work? Am I wrong or is it wrong? And it's just, it's very easy to be confused and skeptical of these things because sometimes we're infatuated more with the new than with the good or like the outcome.
That's right. That's right. Now, help me understand this a little bit, though, Peter. When you talk about consultancy and building businesses around conversational AI, and for the average person who's listening to this, they're probably surprised and they're thinking, well, it's conversational AI. I mean, anybody could have a conversation with AI.
Yeah.
It's new about what you're doing in conversational AI, I guess. Let's go through that.
Yeah. And obviously, this industry has changed very much the last 10 years. Like when I started out, conversational AI was, you know, when you pick up a phone and you press one and you press two, now you can say one and say two as opposed to pressing one and two. And so it kind of started with this very kind of like caveman like thing. And you always heard a friend like yelling into the phone, like, operator, please, over and over again. And what has changed in the past 4 or 5 years is, one, the technology for understanding simple words and languages and stuff has improved to the point that you can make out many of the common, what we call business languages, which are like, you know, northern, global, western languages, are very much understood now by computers and technology. And so then it comes to the point of like, how do we create an artificial scenario? Kind of like, you know, you're watching like a comedy sketch where there's a setup and a premise and an execution. And how do you do it in a way that makes technology at its strong point and set you up for success? Like when you walk into McDonald's, they don't say, "Hey, Robin, how you doing?" Like they're not trying to start anything but a commercial interaction. So they say, "Welcome to McDonald's. May I take your order?" And so for a long time, that is like how you faked AI, was you just made it seem like it's an opening conversation that could only talk about pizza ordering, you know, and it'll just gently put you back. And humans are used to dealing with difficult conversations and they do all the mental work. But now we're in the other end of the seat where now the AI can be told a complex problem and maybe give us a complex solution. And that's kind of like what we experiment with. And I try to help companies not become the beta testers for this new age of technology and to pick the things that do well and keep the things that only humans could do well as their competitive advantage.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's very appropriate with the way you positioned it. We are now at a phase where humans are trying to interact with technology, A, and you know, we're all in different phases of understanding the technology. Some people are understanding and they can work with it at a much degree of confidence. And some people are in the middle and some people probably having a hard time working with it, right? Especially when you get on the phone and you mentioned earlier, like talking to your phone, especially when you get on the phone and the call centers now and a tech, you know, tech support or whatever they are, they're trying to talk to you by embedding AI into the process of the conversation. At the same time, they're trying to inject a human in certain parts. To the large extent, those conversational aspects of AI right now are majorly driven by cost savings and trying to reduce cost. And we fine tune as we go kind of thing, not necessarily test it up front and make sure the technology is hardened before we really deploy it. But it's always been the case since the 90s. I mean, people deploy technology without really vetting it. And basically Microsoft, I mean, I'm not dissing Microsoft and you're in Seattle, but you know, the entire premise of technology was let's deploy it. Let's work the bugs through the, you know, the tech support center. And then we'll come up with a new version of it.
Yeah.
Well, do you have any comments on that?
Well, it's very interesting because technology endures. So when you talk about the systems you're talking to in the 90s, were probably bought by Microsoft in the 2000s. And now it's like so deeply embedded in products like Teams and Office that the person who invented it doesn't even know where their code is anymore. And I think a lot of like conversation stacks are like that. Like I used to work for Microsoft and one of the last projects I worked on was integrating between video chat and talking chat. And they're all different systems. They don't, you know, like the programs hide the fact that it's a singular product, but they're all kind of different things under the hood. So, and businesses who like there's all kinds of like, it's all open source and I can just look at the back end and add stuff. And the problem is like when Microsoft does it for their products, they have a shared boss who can force them to be in a room and work together and coordinate the tooling. But when you as a customer use these products, there's no one to call or no one to ask to like, hey, can you change this thing so my thing works better? And so a lot of the things that I do with my clients is I tell them no a lot, which is probably not good for a consultant to do, but like I tell them, you know, what is the battle you want to solve? How much money are you prepared to spend to like prove that Microsoft is able to do this thing? And most people are just like, they don't care. I just wanted to use Microsoft because we're paying for the subscription. And if I can fire them and like get another product that's cheaper that does what I want, I will do it. And I think a lot of like independent entrepreneurs who have the control of what they use are in favor of doing that. But like when you work for a company, you don't get to pick your tools. So you got to like do what they give you, work what they give you. And I also help people with that.
That's right. That's right. Now, Peter, on the conversational AI right now, in your opinion, based on what you're seeing out there, where does the conversational AI sit in the enterprise stack today? Like, is it in the front end, middleware, or at the decision engine?
Right now, things are, they're kind of sitting at the edge, right? And so the edge being any boundary. So like I walk up to a kiosk in the mall and there's a microphone, I talk into the microphone, or I call the 800 number, or I get on my phone and I press the microphone. And so at that point, a tiny, tiny little model does something we call inference, and it kind of like tries to transcribe what you say into a language that a machine can understand. And so a lot of tools, and this is kind of like when we talk about AI today and ChatGPT, they're large language models. And so the dirty secret is like, it's such a large language model that we're feeding it transcripts of things. So when you send it a picture, it reads the picture and creates a description of the picture like you would give to a person that wouldn't be able to see. And then you feed it to the language model and describe what it is. Mm-hmm. And then it describes the scenario back to you in kind of like a mimicry way. And so a lot of the tooling and a lot of the leaps and bounds of things using AI is they take these 10, 15 year old technologies that have been out there and just have them collect the data that's fed into the LLM.
Okay.
And so
go ahead. Go ahead, Peter.
And so then any number of things can happen depending on the complexity of the structure. And that's kind of like, that's where the hallucinations begin. You know, when we talk about hallucinations,
that's right. Yeah.
Because like when you're, you know, it's like a game of telephone. So I am describing a picture of an elephant to my friend. Am I going to describe it as accurately as a elephant scientist would, or, you know, I can't even come up with the words for it. So I've already failed the exercise. And like,
that's right.
So that game of telephone sets the stage in a cascading failure range of things that have come. And so what I kind of tell people is like, what are computers good at? They're good at filing things fast. They're good at reading things fast. So the number one safest thing for everyone to start off with is, taking an email and copying it into your database. And these kind of tasks that computers have been good at for decades are now you can describe to it the way you want it to be done, as opposed to like clicking through 17 menus in Excel and formatting things. And that is kind of like where we're at. For most people, that's the kind of AI that they're dealing with today.
Yes. Yes. The AI that we're dealing with today, I interviewed somebody on the channel, Sydney Shapiro, Dr. Sydney Shapiro, who teaches postdoctoral candidates in University of Lethbridge, Alberta, the topic of AI. And he had a great explanation for this one. He, you know, until I heard it from him. My background, as I told you yesterday before our prep call, is technology. And I was a DBA for a couple of other companies before when I was younger. And he compared it to me to a large database. You know, we're still indexing things. We're still doing vectoring on those things on the data, because we'll have a larger, much larger ability now to consume data for these models. But the foundation for all this still, in to a large extent, is indexing the data and trying to recognize some patterns within the data. So we haven't really, you know, the marketing of artificial intelligence, I guess, when they threw the word intelligence in the middle, I think that people got excited about it. And they had an expectation from this one that is probably not able to do it.
And they further complicated by starting calling these things, we used to call them chatbots, and now they call them agents, which implies agency, right? Which means like, yeah, the model, when the model goes left, it's because left is the best way to go. And rather, the more accurate way to describe it is it goes left because left is the most common way to go. And so when we're talking about understanding and bias and all that and hallucinations, a lot of things in life are a coin flip, right? Do you like ketchup on your hot dog or not, right? And a machine says, well, 60% of people like ketchup, so I'm going to give you ketchup by default. And so when you run into these like systems where you can't change the outcome because the AI picked ketchup on your hot dog, I know President Obama hates that, and I don't want to be on the cross him. Those are where we get into trouble, I think, as a society, because then you start becoming like a recommendation suddenly becomes autocracy. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, now we only offer ketchup on hot dogs, and there's no way to choose it because we remove the button that lets you undo things and all that. And so those are the other scenarios that like you risk when you go in automation. Is the automation have an exit ramp, and is it too stringent? And does it serve everyone that you need to serve the same way?
That's right. Now, Peter, you talked a little bit earlier about, you know, when you were mentioning the telephone game, when you're trying to describe your situation to AI to come up with an intelligent answer back, you have to actually be describing what you're trying to get out of the technology in a very descriptive, knowledgeable, you know, detailed way to AI to in order for you to obtain something that is half consumable. Now, that leads me to the prompt conversation. Describe to the audience, if you don't mind, what makes up a good prompt based on what you've been through. What is a good prompt?
I'm old enough that when I went in English class and we did a whole couple weeks on who, what, where, when, and why. And so a good prompt is a it's basically a wish, or it's a command, or it's an instruction, and you have who, what, where, when, and why in perfect agreement, and the outcome is clearly understood. So if I'm telling a prompt, hey, I need to book a flight for two people in coach to Miami on the 5th of May at 4:15, if all those things are automatically true, a bot can do that very well. But if any of those things are weird, then you have to arbitrate the understanding of what you want with the reality of what it is. So either that's done through computer logic or brute force or any number of things. And that's basically customer service in a nutshell, right? You come up to the counter, you tell them what's wrong or what you wish to happen, and they tell you how true that is possible or not. And so when we make these systems of conversational AI, we're trying to make, you know, we already tried to make an analog of the customer counter with the catalog, right? The magazine. And then we tried to make an analog of the magazine with the website. And now we're trying to make an analog of the customer counter for the magazine with the website on the chatbot. And so, but if you still go back all the way to like talking to your tailor, like I need a nice suit, it's the same set of things you have to do. It's just now a computer is tasked with like fulfilling this. And maybe it has the ability to do it or not.
Okay. Now, in terms of AI in general, so where do you think the AI conversation is becoming? Like, it feels to me like it's becoming like the new marketing, the new sales team, the new customer support layer. It's all together, all at once, everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like the Peter principle. I'm Peter, and I hear this a lot. But like, No one's working as hard as you are, right? And so everyone assumes that, and the better you are at doing a job, the more it appears like magic. Therefore, I should be able to just tell a machine something and I get it. Like, how hard can it be? And anyone who's been an expert in their field, like everyone has someone at their company that if, God forbid, they missed a day at work, the company would fall apart. And I think what AI is doing is kind of giving a false sense of that person is extendable infinitely using machines, when the reality is you're only extending that first part of the conversation with them, where you ask them where the salt shaker is, or you know, where's the 1099 file, or all those things. But you're not like, you don't have that years of experience of, oh, he's asking about the 1099 file, it must be time to file the X report and all those other related systematic things that humans are good at, like making those connections. And so that disconnect of like, okay, we're going to spend, like ChatGPT spent $12 billion in loss last quarter making AI models. They have no, there's never been a company in the history of the world that lost $12 billion in a quarter and survived. And so the only way a company spends $12 billion and wins is if they become the operating system of the world, you know? And so putting that aside, there's a lot of measure interest in marketing to make AI in everything, even when it doesn't make sense to do so. And so the first thing I do with my clients is I do a gut check of like, what do you like to do in a day? Like, let's put aside like what AI could do. What do you wish you could just outsource? And what is your budget for doing so? And that conversation changes things dramatically, because instead of the chatbot replacing a person, you're having a chatbot replace a service, or chatbot replace like a 20 minutes of my day, I go and I copy all the new emails into an Excel. So we're going to have AI build a tool for that, so you don't have to do that. And so now you have 40 minutes to look at all the new emails in your Excel and sort them, you know, things like that. And we do that in a granular way that is provable and measurable and all that, in a way that black box AI doesn't give us.
Peter, I know you work like, do you work like in all industries, Peter? Or is there a specific industry that you work in?
No, I do. I work in like, you know, small offices. I've worked for banks. I've worked for healthcare. And so all of them have different domains and often in the same company. Like I worked for a large retail chain. You may have heard of them. They're in Arkansas. They're everywhere. They have a healthcare plan that is larger than Medicare in 13 American states. And so their HR department is bigger than most state economies. And so they have all the if you ever had to go to Social Security, they have all those problems that a state would have. And so they're looking for solutions to all kinds of things. And so they have a call center just for HR that has hundreds of people on it. And the kind of problems they would encounter would be like, every phone call is 2 minutes. And the first minute and a half is verification, where you have to prove who you are so we can talk about your private information. So instead of like having a chatbot that does the whole phone call. Let's just do a chatbot that does the verification while you're waiting on hold to talk to the person. So now you only need a minute to ask the question and get off. And so these are kind of like the counterintuitive things of like, yeah, we can outsource everything to AI, but what if we just do a little AI and see how that goes, right? And see if we can chip away at things that no one likes to do before we start like having it badly do things that people are pretty good at.
Yeah. Hey, Peter, since you work in the various industries, and I'm assuming various industries look at the risks, regulations, human trust, ethics, and perhaps liability in some cases, right? So each industry would look at it differently. Like if you try to, you know, handle a few voicemails or voice calls in a mechanic shop, it's different than handling it in a healthcare facility or healthcare provider facility to that extent. So what are the biggest risks company ignore, perhaps from your point of view, when they deploy conversational AI in which they probably should be taking a harder look at?
Well, like, you know, I'll give a great example. Like the other day at the time of this recording, ChatGPT announced ChatGPT Health, which to me blows my mind because their organization is currently seeing many lawsuits, which they're accused of helping people commit self-harm. And now they're announcing the healthcare version of it. So, you know, there's like a lot of things where...
It's not adding up, Peter. It's not adding
it's
up.
It's not adding up. You know, like technology, people think technology can solve all things. But like yep. a million monkeys on a million typewriters can't write Shakespeare. You know, like, and I think they're solving problems that are like their investors want them to solve. But no one's like no one's problem is like, oh, I'm sick of talking to my doctor. You know, they're begging for access to their doctor. They want to have as much time as they need with their doctor. They don't want to like delegate to another non-discussion with a doctor, you know, so.
So who's liable at the end of the day? Like so, somebody goes wrong, something goes wrong, who's liable?
So that's a great question. So the lawsuits I mentioned that ChatGPT or number, their defense in it is the person was using it wrong when they had the chatbot given the information which they can harm themselves. And that blows my mind.
Are we into the same phase as the, you know, what's it called? Like in the US, you guys probably have more discussion about it than we have here in Canada, is the weapon industry, right? So when somebody, God forbid, gets shot, it's not the weapons problem, yeah. It's the person who's holding the weapon. Is that
right.
the kind of
yeah.
conversation
yeah.
we're having
yeah.
right now?
Yeah. Well, that's the defense that the Council for OpenAI is going with, is that AI doesn't kill people, people kill people, right? And to me, like, I read a heartbreaking story the other day from a writer I like very much, who was describing how his father refused to take the advice from his own doctor on easily treatable cancer because they were in this parasocial relationship with a AI provider that had them convinced they had a completely different condition. And it kept citing these papers. So the son reached out to the people who wrote the paper and got them to write a letter to the dad saying they agree with the doctor, please get the treatment. And he never got the treatment and he passed away. And to me, I think the company that makes AI is absolutely responsible in the same way that if I told you bad stock advice, you know, or any kind of other thing, I would be liable to some sort of civil case against you. And so that means, like, as a company, you have to be very careful what you put online. Like, I worked with a banking company in Australia, and they were doing something. They were trying to automate the phone line, you know, trying to cut down call time. And they had a very good process. But every 6 weeks it got into a meeting, they would suddenly be very hyper-focused on autonomous, no human escalation scenarios. And I'm like, well, you know, there are pitfalls, you know, there's pluses and minuses, and you need to be able to measure them. And I didn't see them for a year. And next time I saw them, they were testifying in front of the Australian version of the Senate because they had outsourced an entire call center and were using AI to make the people in another country sound like they're native Australians. And the call center employees that they laid off were a union contract, which was a protected legal contract in the Commonwealth of Australia. And so, like, it's kind of like you mess around and you find out, in a way, with a lot of these things.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's, yeah. like, you can claim whatever you want, but then it won't stop you from a lawsuit. And so I think a lot of, like, almost every AI you see says AI facts may be inaccurate, which is, like, crazy when you're going to Google.com. Like, why did I go to Google.com if I wanted inaccurate results? And I think we're kind of, like, in this weird inflection moment where AI as a brand is not super well-regarded and trustworthy. We talk about AI slop, and people are really desperate for like veritas and, you know, reliable sources of information. So, you know, that is something that's very hard, especially like even for me as a person who's like talking about measured AI usage. You know, I have colleagues and friends who think I'm a booster in the way that, you know, I don't want AI to write me an album or make me a movie, you know, because there's plenty of movies I still haven't seen yet made by people. And like, why do we need to generate these things at a McDonald's scale of things? But I do want AI to like make sure I don't miss important emails, because I get 150 new emails every morning and a lot of it's not stuff I want to see.
That's right. Now, speaking of all the pitfall and that we need to watch for when we use a technology, what couldn't help but think, you know, because a human are designing these technologies, Peter. I mean, you design, you know, at various scales, right? So at your scale, at, you know, Alterman scale, Sam Alterman scale.
Yeah.
But what kind of guardrails do you think we should put in place to prevent the bad things from happening? To prevent, right now, yeah. I feel like, you know, human are dealing with AI. AI is still a teenager and we're treating it like an adult.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think at least that.
Yeah. Well, we do a lot of tooling in our side projects. And I think, yeah, working with AI is a lot like being kind of like a Montessori teacher, you know, where you're just like, you put the AI in a sandbox and you tell it, you can't do anything without asking me first. And then when it asks me, like, no, of course not. And until you get to the point where you trust it to not offer anything that is like completely wrong or unethical, you don't let it talk to people in any scenario. And so what that does is like, one, it shows that you can't do an everything bot. It's never going to, well, at least with the current gen of technology, you can never make a general automated AI assistant that knows everything. Humans don't need that, as long as it says like, I can't talk about that right now. But the way we talked about prompts, and the way that like the Altmans of the world do is they put in a prompt that says, don't do that. And so now AI can't read a picture of Abraham Lincoln. So many people have read a picture of current presidents and like done things with them with the AI. So they say, don't describe presidents or talk about presidents. And so now the tool is completely useless for discussing anything political, because they put a very clumsy, you know, poorly understood semantic rule in there. And so now I can't even describe, like, you paint me a picture of Woodrow Wilson. You can't, right? Because they're trying to, like, you know, it's like fingers in the leaking boat. And so they're trying to plug all the holes in the boat. And eventually you run out of room in that prompt for anything but the rules. And so they have to like pick and choose which rules are most important. And so maybe they pick and choose a rule about self-harm so they can make sure that they get the contract for the launching the missiles in the Army AI contract or whatever. And so, yeah, that's also like a big problem too with these AI systems, is that they're a closed box. We don't know what is forbidden and what is allowed. And it's not always intuitive which is which.
So, which leads me to the next, I guess, conclusion out of all this. Do you think we're headed into a regulated conversational systems?
I think so. I think, like, you know, there's serious discussion right now, like in the UK, over banning X, formerly Twitter, because their AI chatbot will happily make illegal pornographic materials of minors or celebrities or your ex-wife or whatever. And obviously that is like horrific, and like the company should be ashamed of themselves. But also, like, yeah, if they won't regulate themselves, people will regulate them. And I think like that is like been the history of everything for all time, that you have to abide by the rules and the morals and the standards of the venue in which you operate. And maybe tech people are really like high in their own supply and they think like they're unstoppable, but there is going to be either you self-regulate or you have regulation imposed on you. And I think that is coming one way or the other.
Yeah. Now, what is your thoughts on LLM versus SLM? Those, for the audience, large language model versus small language models, where people are now deploying them at a smaller miniature scale behind the firewall in some cases, or you can use them for your own if you want to. They're available on an open source, I'm assuming.
Well, you know, that is a really great point. It is very hard to run an LLM on a computer you can buy in the store, like for my personal use. But you can run these SLMs on your phone or on smaller and old devices. And so what a lot of companies are doing now quietly, because it kind of undercuts the LLM story, is you make kind of like a distributed system of like, you use the best LLM for the job, or the machine model for the job, or the best thing for the job. And so you don't need to have these huge, you know, $12 billion a quarter monstrosities, only in certain scenarios, right? And so, like, every day I wake up and I say, what's next, to my little helper bot, and it tells me my day. Like, that doesn't have to be fancy AI. That could just be regex or just pattern matching. Like, I'm a creature of habits. We all are. And so that's computer programs. Your programs are basically like procedures codified into a recipe. And so, like, if you use it correctly every day, you don't need LLMs at all, right? Like, you have a program for your life. And so if we put LLMs at the back of the chain, we only use it to, like, come up with new things or to make a one-time problem, I think is kind of the where this thing is going, because I don't think LLMs are sustainable. They kind of have reached the ceiling of what LLM technology can hit without, like, the laws of physics coming in with computer speed processing and all that. And you'll never win a bet saying technology will never happen, right? Because everything will prove you wrong. But there are some things that are hard limits. And there's tooling that we've built for decades, you know, in computer technology, that when used with the new stuff in a smart way, can bring out the best of both, right? And I think that's kind of, like, we're going to move into that period of, like, the orchestration between, you know, I've worked for clients who have computers underneath their desk that were made in the 90s, and it's using custom software that would cost thousands of dollars to rewrite, and they use AI to, like, just take the data model and run it on modern machinery so they can turn this poor computer off that's been on for 30 straight years. And so these are the kind of things I think we're going to start seeing, where we optimize for, like, effectiveness, and we optimize for value, and we stop just, like, setting the world on fire to, like, make pictures of dumb things.
Now, what is the future you think is going to look like from a conversational AI? Do you think we'll be typing in 5 years, or is this going to move to a talk to bots kind of thing?
I mean, I think, like, I've worked a lot in conversational design and putting chatbots on the stuff. And I think there's scenarios that don't make any sense to make conversational. And conversely, there's things that are, like, it's hard. You have to describe it, because it's not like ordering a hamburger. You have to be like, okay, I woke up this morning and my car wouldn't start, and it makes a noise, you know, like that kind of, like, descriptive, like, I don't know the words for that to tell you, but I can describe it. And so if we can separate those concerns of, like, okay, maybe conversational AI is a green light on my desk that when it's green, I hit it and something good happens. And when it's red, I hit it, something bad goes away. And it doesn't have to be a chat. It just is, we call it modality. So, like, it is the most efficient thing for the scenario in which it occurs, right? And so I think we're going to start seeing more multimodal experiences where, like, maybe I'm talking on my phone and describing something to a friend and something pops up on my screen so I can show them on the video call what I'm talking about. And so, you know, there's all kinds of different modalities and things like that. And I want to see, you know, I'm very excited for more of that where I don't have to carry a laptop on a phone and, you know, make a phone call, you know, have a meeting about an email and stuff like that. And I think there's, like, a lot of things that are just kind of, like, inefficient and a waste of time that could be simplified if we just, like, stop trying to, you know, like, every time I talk to a chatbot that is showing me a picture of a website inside of another website, I feel silly, right? You know, like, it's like, why isn't the website one big chatbot? You know, like, why does it have to be in the tiny little corner of the screen? And I think people are going to get over these kind of, like, separation of concern and just make something that is appropriate for the role that it needs to be in.
Yeah. Now, just if you can, maybe for the audience, just in looking for your opinion, there's a lot of companies that listen to this podcast and entrepreneurs, et cetera. So in your opinion, Peter, what separates companies that win from those who get commoditized in this age going forward?
I think companies that understand the value they have and is their expertise are going to win. Because, like, we saw it, I don't know, people who remember Amazon, when before Amazon was Amazon, they were a bookstore. And then there was ToysRUs.Amazon.com and SoAndSo.Amazon.com. And all those companies that did that are gone now. And Amazon is Amazon. And I think a lot of the things of AI, they want to, like, take your expertise and they want you to, like, assume yourself and become part of them to the point where they don't need you anymore and they have all your information. So I think, like, people really should understand their role and their brand and what makes them different. And the smaller you are, I think the more intimate the relationships you have with your clients and customers is your competitive advantage. So, you know, don't, like, my dentist switched to using the ChatGPT voice for the call center. And so now when they pick up the phone, I don't hear Debbie. I hear the ChatGPT voice I hear every day. I'm just like, I miss Debbie. Like, I know Debbie, I know Debbie is busy and she has to do paperwork and stuff like that. But like, you know, Debbie's a person that I look forward to seeing. And, you know, you've made the experience arguably worse by normalizing it to what everyone else is using.
So do you think this is a generational problem? Like, our generation maybe probably doesn't want to do that now?
Yeah, I mean, I am a elder millennial, so I'm exactly the last cohort that did everything. Like, I went to college and I recorded bands on analog tape. And the next year they went to computers and, like, you know, I didn't have a cell phone until my mid-20s because I didn't have to. And I think about that a lot. I think about the year I was born and the year that is now is substantially different from a technology standpoint. And like I remember when TV stopped. You know, like, you would watch TV a certain hour of the day, and then there was no more TV. And
they now only broadcast certain hours a day, right? They didn't broadcast
Yeah. And that's got to do something to a culture, right? Where there's just a TV screaming every corner of the world at every time of the day. And so, like, you know, are things better or worse? You know, we'll let the social scientists dig into that. But I think, like, one thing that you're seeing a lot is people are really hungry for real physical connection. Like, you know, especially, like, where are third spaces and where are, like, communities and stuff happening? And I think people are going offline. Like, a lot of my friends don't do social media anymore. They've detoxed from social media and they're like, hey, I'm just going to join a good book group. And so maybe we're going to see a generational shift away from, you know, this.
The pendulum swinging the other side.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you know, it couldn't hurt. I don't think a book club has ever hurt anyone to the degree that a chat room has. You know, like, someone may send me some horror stories, but you know, it's really a great point. And I think, like, the only reason I use technology is so I get time in the day to do the things I really want to do. And if it's filling it up with more and more technology, then I'm going to have to find a different mode of existing, because, like, I don't. Computers are neat, but they're not more neat than going to hear a good opera, you know, or seeing a great play or reading a good book, you know.
That's right. And, you know, that's another thing too, like, AI is getting into producing music now, and you flip YouTube on and then you've got everybody putting out music that is generated by AI. I like music, but I'm not listening to it by music generated by AI kind of things.
I mean, yeah, I think you're old enough as I am to, we used to call it Muzak, right? Or elevator music, right? Like, it was just like, yeah. And it is like industrial music that is, like, made for a purpose that's not pleasant listening. They used to play Muzak in the slaughterhouses because it relaxed the animals, you know. And so, like, who wanted this problem solved? Who's like, there isn't enough music. There's a million records to come out every day. Like, what do we need a machine to do that for? What we do need is a machine that makes it easier for people who are good at music to get their music recorded and out to the world. And, like, just think how many people who never get to go into a recording studio that write beautiful songs that no one gets to hear. You know, it just, you know, it makes me kind of, like, sad that people are working on that problem when, you know, so many other problems we can be spending our time on.
Absolutely. Just from your perspective, based on what we're talking about right now, Peter, if you were to look at where we are right now from a tech perspective and where people are using it, the way they're using technology, what do you think scares you the most of where we're heading?
I think the scary thing about tech is that the customer is no longer as important as the investor return. And so, like, when technology used to be about building a better mousetrap, right? And you become like, here's the best watch in the industry, or here is the best way to do X. And now all these products come and they go, and they, you know, announce a product and it goes away and it comes out as a new product, and Skype comes and goes, and Google Hangouts and all the, where I feel like we've stopped, like, figuring out how to build things in a way to a completion or to, like, a milestone. Like, the last email, I can't even think of the last new email feature I've seen. The best email feature in the last 40 years is probably 30 seconds. It'll wait before it sends it. So, like, you send it and then 10 seconds later, you're like, and you unsend it and you type the thing you forgot to say. But what has email done since then that's good, you know, in terms of, like, writing emails? It's hard to say. And I think, like, it's because the people who make software, how they measure success is completely divorced from the people who use it. And so, and I think, like, if you just sat for a second, I've owned product and I've sat and just, I don't say anything. I just watch them use it. And I think almost no one in tech has an experience like that. You're just like, it's like watching a dog chew on a telephone. It's like, no, it goes up to your ear. And But you learn a lot about like human nature and how things are built and understood. And so we're so disconnected from that experience of like, can you tell me from memory what all the buttons in Microsoft Word does at the top of the screen? Absolutely not, right? Because you never use them. Yeah. And so like, why are they there? If you have to search it, you might as well just have a search box. And so
some engineer somewhere thought it was a good idea, Peter.
Yeah. Well, I definitely need to always have bold, italic, and unitalic buttons in front of me at all times because I'm constantly switching bold and italic. I mean, it's silly. And obviously the person who shipped that feature probably spent 6 years of their life developing and building it. You know, when has someone made a better typewriter? You know, that's a problem there.
It just reminded me of when I used to work in the tech sector, in the telecom sector, I used to talk to these engineers and I asked the question, what did you just create here? What is this? Oh, it does this neat feature, it does this. And they explain it to me. They're very excited about it. And the biggest question I ask is, I trip them up, how are you going to make money out of this? Who's buying it? And that's where, you know, the disconnect happened. Because it's neat, because it can do X amount of things that they're neat, not necessarily because the user needs it or wants to use it or using it effectively.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I left working with the big guys was I went to too many meetings with like 40% of users asked, preferred this feature than the other feature. And they're like, 40%? Wow, that's a lot of people. How many people did you talk to in total? 9. You know, like, and it's just like, yeah, okay,
the sample size is pretty tiny.
I'm not a statistician. I am not a social scientist, but like I ask questions of like, I know how to lie. I know people lie with numbers, right? And I think that's the other thing about, you know, AI is like, it makes it really easy to lie with numbers, but it also makes it really easy to unwrap the lies with numbers because you can do very expensive search queries and stuff. So hopefully that will empower people more than it unempowers them is my fervent hope for the future of tech.
Absolutely. Hey, Peter, I was just going to tell you that I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you come back to the channel here have another conversation with me.
Yeah.
That's such a delightful way to end the day on Friday afternoon. Talk about all these topics that we near and dear to both of our hearts here. That's good. Any last comments, any closing comments on your side, Peter?
No, you know, I just think of my little Jewish grandmother. She said the only way to be street smart is always say no. So, you know, when you're trying new technologies, like you don't have to say yes. You know, if it sounds too good to be true, say no.
That's right. Nobody's forcing you to say yes. Well, they try, but you can say no.
Yeah. It's fine. It's their job to make you say yes, not your job to say yes.
Absolutely. So I want to thank you, Peter, for coming online here with me and spending an hour with me this afternoon. Really appreciate it. And for the audience, thank you so much for listening in. I really appreciate you tuning in on YouTube and our podcast channels. Happy to report we're for the past 7 days, cumulatively, we have about 2.5 million viewers on the channel. So it's pretty interesting now. I'm really happy how this channel is progressing. And thank you again for tuning in. Thanks for listening in. And I'll see you guys at the next episode. Thanks a lot.